You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 282, by Rudolf Steiner, cycle of lectures entitled Speech and Drama, translated by Mary Adams. This is Lecture 6, entitled Sensitive Perception for Sound and Word Instead of for Meaning and Idea, 10th of September, 1924. My dear friends, we will now see how we can find the transition from practice in speech, as such, to dialogue, to the treatment of drama. For this is what is needed in the art of the stage, that from the right forming of speech, a powerful new impulse shall make itself felt there. Many people today are deeply dissatisfied with the drama as it is, and the cause of their dissatisfaction lies to no small extent, lies indeed mainly, in the fact that the stage has entirely lost the old traditions, I mean the traditions of very long ago, and has not yet found any point of departure which could lead to the creation of something new. Truth is, the new thing needed never will be found until we approach the matter from a spiritual standpoint. Let us, therefore, now go on to consider what guidance a spiritual outlook can give for the treatment of dialogue, trialogue, and so forth. We will take for our starting point a recitation that will be given by Frau Dr. Steiner. And since in the matter of giving artistic form to conversation, Molière may be said to have brought drama to a high degree of excellence, we have chosen for our recitation a scene from one of his plays. We shall, of course, try to find also in German literature some similarly striking example. But there is no doubt about it. In Molière, we do have a particularly good demonstration of the way conversation should be treated on the stage, all the back and forth of retort and repartee. We will, accordingly, begin today with a scene from Molière. And now Frau Dr. Steiner speaks. I'm taking a scene out of Les Misanthropes. We are introduced to a coquettish young widow who has many admirers and is on this account an object of envy to her not altogether faithful lady friend. She has a sharp tongue, this young widow, and has just been letting off witty remarks at the expense of some of her admirers. At this moment her false friend, in reality her enemy, is announced. And readers aside, okay, long quote, few pages in French, and then in English, the same thing, few pages. And then there is another piece, I guess it's Goethe's Zwei Teufchen und Amor, which is in German. That again is a few pages, and are Two Little Devils and Cupid is what it's called. Again, this is the English, and now we are back to Dr. Steiner again. When it is a question of giving form to a dialogue or to a wider conversation, what we have to look to, most of all, is that the art shall be true, true that is as art. Naturalism, which aims at imitating external reality, can never be true as art. For consider the very conditions within which we find ourselves on the stage. What we have to do there is obviously to represent, to act, and never to forget that we are acting. No servile imitation of real life can ever override our obligation to act. The acting will provide the material with which we have to work as artists. We shall have to find all we need in the acting itself. The first thing to have in mind is that in art, everything must be perceptible, must be immediately present to the spectator or listener. The moment he has to fill out what is given from his own resources, the moment he is obliged to add something of his own construction, for example, in the theater, before he can understand some actor who comes onto the stage, we have come away from the realm of art. The artistic representation should comprise everything the audience needs for its comprehension. The artist of the stage has at his disposal, first of all, the word in its artistic formation. And then he has also mime, gesture, posture. A genuine artist will endeavor to express by means of these everything the audience require to have before them. One could point to many things in present-day civilization that frustrate this ideal. An outstanding one is the fact that we have no longer today any true feeling for sound or for word. We have feeling only for ideas. We look through the word to its meaning, to the idea that is behind it. We have completely unlearned how to understand in hearing, and in ordinary life we are all too inclined merely to hear in understanding. There is an essential difference between the two: understanding in hearing, hearing in understanding. And it is most important for you to be clear in your minds about the difference. It will help you to discern it if we recall at this point some things that I said in the earlier lectures, looking at them now from a rather different angle. You will remember I pointed out that no single sound is ever formed by the human soul without its reflecting, in the case of a vowel, some inner feeling of the soul that may be experienced in connection with the world outside. Or in the case of a consonant, without an endeavor to imitate in the very way the sound is formed, some external object, some external being or process. Whenever I intone the sound ah, then if I am not content with perceiving the meaning or the idea, but want to develop a feeling for the sound, pure and simple, the intonation of ah will, under all circumstances, imply an experience of wonder or astonishment. That this is no longer felt in the language of everyday intercourse, that the experience has completely faded out, makes no difference at all. And every time I intone E, there lies behind it the joy and delight that the soul experiences with the assertion of the self. When I intone OO, there is always behind it some feeling of fear or anxiety. Each vowel sound expresses an experience of the soul occasioned by something in the world outside. Every sound, on the other hand, that is consonantal is in character, expresses an effort on the part of the soul to imitate, in the forming of the sound, some external object or process. When I say the sound, I am, of course, obliged, in order to utter it, to have recourse to the help of a vowel. It is nevertheless the consonant with which I am here concerned. When I intone b, there lies behind it an endeavor to imitate something that covers or protects. True, this original endeavor of the soul has today gone far down into the unconscious, has gone down, shall we say, into the stomach that digests food but not sounds. Nevertheless, it is still true that the intoning of b signifies that I am speaking of the shell or sheath of something. Ar denotes that I am endeavoring to form a sound picture in imitation of a process of commotion and excitement or trembling. Readers aside, I'm trying to roll my R. I apologize. It's an R sound. Ar. End of readers aside. The consonants imitate. They shape themselves in imitation of forms or processes, of things or events in the world outside. It follows from this that wherever, for example, an ah appears in a word, we shall ultimately find hidden away within the word the inner experience of wonder. For our present study, we can naturally go no further than the German language, but the same holds good, as I shall show a little later, for all languages. The modifications that have come about are to be explained in quite other ground, on other grounds. Suppose you utter the simple word Bont, parenthesis, a band or ribbon, close parenthesis. There is, you see, an ah in it. What lies behind this word? The answer I am about to give is in reality more exact than all the explanations offered nowadays by learned philologists. I have no wish to call in question the learning of these scholars, but when it comes to treating of what is artistic in speech and language, they can offer us very little help. What, then, can we find in a word like Bont? Without a doubt, there is contained in it the fact that when the word first came into being, men felt it to be a cause of wonder, that they could bind something together with a Bont that then held. And it is wonderful that we can gather a thing together and make it fast in this way, with a Bont. The vowel of a word will always reveal for us the inner experience of soul that gave rise to the word. And when I have, in quotes, bound something, then the bont is around it. B always expresses a covering, a wrapping sound. Whether the covering be a whole house, or a family, or merely such scant covering as a piece of ribbon, the sound B will always contain the meaning of wrapping or sheltering. N expresses a lightness of touch, readers aside, N, as in no, and a readers aside. Let me say that, read that again. N expresses a lightness of touch, suggesting something that easily flows or slips off. Bont. And then the D expresses a making firm and fast. D gives one the feeling of something satisfactorily finished off. We fasten the bont, and there the word ends. At first the bont is loose, n, then we fasten it, d. Thus can one feel one's way through the whole word, sound by sound. If men had always felt toward words and sounds as they do today, feeling merely the meaning and the idea, adopting, in fact, an entirely intellectual attitude, it would never have been possible for words to come into existence as words of a language. A language can be born only out of experience, out of inner soul experience. And as words signify something external, they have to be born out of an experience man has with something other than himself, with something, in fact, in his environment. In the interjections, we have opportunity, even now, to see how words were originally formed. Interjections are indeed the only instances left where men still feel today, though it be but feebly, what is really there in the word. I said that ooh has always to do with an experience of fear or anxiety, how F is always an indication that something is coming forth from its place of origin, is escaping from its corner, parenthesis, hence the German expression for knowing something very thoroughly, to understand it, aus dem F, to understand it, that is, right from its very beginnings. A keenly sensitive feeling is behind expressions of this kind, close parenthesis. And so, if from some corner you suddenly sense the approach of something that alarms you and fills you with fear, you will say, oof, and you will even direct the F sound inward instead of outward as you utter it. What we are still able to experience with interjections can really be experienced with every single word. Here someone will very naturally interpose, quote, "But if that were so, all languages would have to be alike. There would be only one language for the whole world." Close quote. In reply, all I can say is that in reality, there is only one language. That sounds very strange. Nevertheless, it is so. There is one language, only no one speaks this language. How is that? Take the simple German word Kopf, head. Starting with the O sound we have in the first place, the inner experience of roundness, O, is always something that embraces or surrounds, and in a mood of sympathy. Similarly, we could show that the K, the P, and the F, what the word Kopf wants to say. Primarily, however, Kopf expresses the round form of the human head. Kopf is the endeavor of the soul to imitate in word picture the shape and form of the head. Now, it is peculiar to the German to remark particularly the shape of the head, its spherical form, and to want to imitate that in speech. And he does it not only for the human head, he speaks of Kohlkopf when he wants to imitate in speech the round form of the Kohl, which is cabbage in German. Kohlkopf is, of course, also the recognized technical term in thieves' language for the human head. Parenthesis, for thieves have, as you know, a language of their own. A thief would never say Kopf for a man's head, but always Kohlkopf. They have their own names for everything. Close parenthesis. In the Italian or the French, if the Italian or the Frenchman had the same feeling about the head, if he also wanted to express its roundness, then he too would call it Kopf. He could not use any other word for it. Naturally, the word would in this country have undergone some change due to sound shifting, but that does not affect the issue. The Italian does not, however, want to express the form or shape of the head. He wants to signify that something has been determined by the head, has been declared. So he says testa, parenthesis, you have the same meaning in the word testament, close parenthesis, denoting with the word the attestation given by the human head. If the German felt a desire to express this fact about the head, he too would say testa and not Kopf, for it is really so. For any one thing, only one word is possible, so long as the thing is looked at from the same point of view. Thus it is definitely not in the making of their words that nations differ, but in what they feel and experience in the objects. One nation will draw attention to the spherical form of the head, another to the statements that proceed from the mouth. It would be quite possible to gather up all languages into one, and then in this universal language there would be Kopf, Testa, and so on, all together. And each nation might then choose out the words that accorded with its character. The sounds in these word pictures have undergone some shifting in course of time. That is how the languages have come to be apparently so very different from one another. But the essence of the word persists. It is always there. And it is just in the most grotesque dialect words that you will often be able to recognize their original and essential element. One can indeed make very interesting studies in this matter of dialect. The Austrian dialect contains, for example, the word Bakscherli. Readers aside, I'm going to spell that B-A-G-S-C-H-I-R-L-I. Bakscherli is how I'm going to pronounce that. End of readers aside. The very sounds of the word will always give the Austrian the feeling that the thing described as being Bakscherli is quaint, is rather funny, but has nevertheless to be taken seriously. He likes it for its oddness, but he knows he must not forget that it is, for all that, sober truth. Bakscherli has to carry, in fact, many nuances of meaning. And now, what is this word? It is simply the word possierlich, droll, translated into Austrian dialect. But the Austrian never feels in his word the nuance that possierlich bears. Readers aside, I will spell that P-O-S-S-I-E-R-L-I-C-H, possierlich. And it reads aside. There is for him far too little heart in possierlich. To call something possierlich is as if one were looking down from a remote height of great learning. And the Austrian is not proud of what he has learned. He says he is, but in reality he is inwardly proud of what he has not learned. And so he can't leave the word as it is. He must adapt it to his lighter, easier way of taking life. And for his taste in bakshirli, he has a marvelous, perfectly marvelous word picture. Analyze the two words from the point of view of sound, and you will find they bring you into a whole new world of experience. Possierlich, bakshirli. So, you see, the feeling for sound and the feeling for word are verily still there in man. They have only been pushed down in more recent times into the unconscious or semi-conscious, into the realm of instinct. If, however, we want to qualify for speaking on the stage, we have to stop stressing the importance of meaning and idea and begin to think again for the significance of sound and word. And that is what we have now to consider together. How an understanding for these things can be brought into the preparation of students for the stage. When you are studying music, you learn many things that you would not think of playing at a concert, for it is certainly not customary to have five-finger exercises and such like performed in public. You learn how to do these exercises, then you go on working at them until what you at first had to take pains to learn passes over into instinct, becomes use, becomes habit. Where students are being prepared for the stage, we do not always find things done in this way. Yet there is such a thing as an art of the stage. And he who would be an artist there must once more come to have a feeling for sound and for word. And out of this feeling develop the true artistic speaking that belongs to the stage. Let us take first dialogue. Two people are standing there on the stage, engaged in more or less serious conversation. When we are facing merely the external world, then if we enter fully into the experience, we feel in vowels and imitate in consonants. And if we have acquired a sensitiveness for sound, something very fruitful will develop out of our relationship to the things and beings of the world. But here we are facing a person, and we have moreover to reckon as well with the audience. For it is certainly my experience that the audience is quite an important factor in the art of the stage. I have never yet found that actors took much pleasure in playing to an empty house. The audience, then, the spectators, are also there as a third party. Now, a dialogue on the stage has to reveal the whole changing course of the reciprocal relationship between the two speakers. This means that each must have, as he listens to the other, the sound feeling that the other is experiencing. Imagine you have the two actors before you. The first should be able, while listening to what the second is saying, to experience in a living manner the sound feeling that is inherent in what is being said. This will not necessarily correspond to the vowels and consonants that are uttered, for in our present day language, these will not always express the mood of the speaker. We do not, for example, say in German us nuhut gefuhr, as we would have to, if we were to form a word picture exactly to accord with experience. We say es nahet gefahr, danger is near. Again, these two examples, us nuhut gufur, Es nahet gefahr. Owing to gradual metamorphosis, what was originally a true word picture has nearly faded away. The speech of the stage must, however, restore to the word its original truth. How is this to be done? Here we come to an important factor in the technique of the stage, to which we must pay careful attention. If you go back from German to Gothic, and even Gothic, you must remember, is a derived language, you will be astonished to find how often you will suddenly come upon vowels that reflect with absolute accuracy emotions of fear, wonder, etc., in words where, in the newer language, the vowels have no more than a neutral relation to experience. This lost relation of sound to experience has now to be supplied in another way. We have on the stage the two actors, one speaking, the other listening. We must in some way bring it about that the second receives the content of what the first says in its true, in quotes, sound significance. If someone were to say to me on the stage, Es nahet gefahr, I ought, of course, to experience wonder, awe. The fact is, we only do not say, Us nuhut gufur, because a metamorphosis has gradually come about, which has led to the replacement of an expression of fear by an expression of wonder. Out of a kind of boldness, we have let fear and anxiety give place to wonder and astonishment. Such changes in sound can always be accounted for. The actor, however, whilst the other is saying Es nahet gefahr, will have to feel in himself the feeling Ooh. This must go on, as it were, behind the scenes of the acting. Hidden behind in the soul of the actor, the sound feeling has to play its part. The listening actor must learn to hear this hidden sound. How is he to do so? Naturally, not by bethinking himself while the other is speaking, now I must feel an ooh. Rather must his training have induced in him such an exact and living feeling for the sound of each single consonant and vowel that when the other speaks words suggestive of fear, he will, as he listens, irrespective of what vowels the words contain, experience instinctively in his soul a corresponding sound feeling for fear. This must, of course, not wait for the performance. The actor must have the experience beforehand in the rehearsals. If the other actor expresses wonder, astonishment, then he will feel awe. If joy, he will feel e. If the words of the other show him to be surprised and taken aback, then the listening actor will feel ow. Ow is in loud, and so on. But now all this must come about in the soul of the actor as naturally as the vibration on the drum of the ear, which we certainly do not ourselves set going, but which is in very truth a gift of the gods. Otherwise we would make as bad a job of hearing as we do of speaking. It should happen quite as a matter of course that when one actor expresses fear, the other's whole mood of soul is attuned to ooh. And when words are spoken that evoke sympathy, then the soul of the listener vibrates in I. This inner hearing has to become absolutely instinctive. It must simply be there of itself. This, then, is what we must aim at in our training for the stage. And that is why we have to take our start from sensitiveness for word and for sound, instead of giving our first attention to ideas. Think for a moment how it is with colors, with blue, for instance. Blue is not in reality simply blue. Take a blue surface and place it by the side of red. It is at once quite different. Place it next to violet, it is different again. By the side of red, it is much more intense blue than it is by the side of violet. The fact is, we never see a color that is not modified by the color that is beside it. And this is true of everything in life. Our impressions are determined and conditioned by neighboring impressions. They receive their nuance from them. Suppose one of the two who are engaged in a dialogue makes a remark that indicates danger. Instinctively, the other will feel ooh, ooh, ooh. And now he begins to form his answer. His answer will sound altogether different when he utters it out of the feeling of ooh than it would be if he were to speak it out of the feeling of ah. It is the same as with the blue color, which is different according to whether it is beside violet or beside red. If the actors have learned to develop this sensitiveness for the sound feeling behind each other's words, then the conversation will receive its right coloring. And the spectator down below in the stalls, yes, and even the spectator up in the gallery, will hear this coloring. Naturally, he does not tell you so. He knows nothing about it consciously, but for that very reason knows it instinctively all the more surely. And if he hears the right coloring, the piece pleases him. If not, he doesn't care for it. That is the way it shows itself, the one and only way. So here we have a definite suggestion for training. The student has but to practice himself in sensitiveness for all the several sounds. There are no more than 32 or 33 altogether, and the corresponding feelings will come, if he will only make up his mind to become conscious of them. And when, once he has experienced these corresponding feelings and proved for himself how they arise in him, when ooh or oh or ah or e is intoned, then he will have to practice this hearing in the rehearsals, just as one practices the piano, playing at first each note consciously and gradually progressing to ease and fluency. Little by little, as the rehearsals proceed, the student will come to the point where he will have instinctively the right sound feeling for the different parts that are being acted around him. When he has attained to this, he may be said to have completed his training in this respect. Here, again, it has naturally to be a question of setting up an ideal, for in the rush of modern life, a play will frequently have no more than two or three rehearsals, possibly even fewer. It is, however, of no little importance that in a matter of this kind we should have before us an ideal. There is, you know, considerable difference of opinion on the subject of rehearsals. For Frau Wilbrandt, who had, by the way, an excellent speaking voice on the stage and divined instinctively much of what I have been describing, for her feeling, a whole series of rehearsals was never enough. She was frequently heard to say that one can only act a part really well when one is acting it in public for the 50th time. The first 49 performances are simply further rehearsals. Yes, she would repeat that again and again. And there is truth in it, for only by that time would the things of which we are speaking have become instinctive and spontaneous. One meets also with other views. There was once a company that had played a piece 50 times. For the 51st performance, the producer proposed to have the prompter's box removed, thinking that by now the actors must surely have their parts by heart. Quote, "Now, boys," he said, "today you are playing the piece for the 51st time, so we'll take away the prompter's box." Close quote. One of the actors could not at first grasp the situation at all. After thinking it over, he said, quote, "But won't that mean that the audience can see the prompter?" Close quote. That the box was to be removed, that he could grasp, but the prompter, he couldn't possibly do without his prompter. I can assure you many changes will have to come about in connection with the art of the stage, and not only in practical matters of this kind. An entirely new approach is needed. We need to think of our work as actors in a new way. If, however, you once begin to put into practice the things of which we are speaking here, then, as time goes on, the various faults and failings will gradually all be overcome. The end of Lecture 6.